The book of Job is regarded as the oldest book in the Bible, written before the book of Genesis was written by Moses. Many believe that the author of the book is Elihu, who is introduced in chapter 32, who composes, according to those who believe that he is the author, he composed this drama shortly after it occurred. Now, the book is hard to follow. Most of Job is a debate between Job and his friends. As they speak, they jump from point to point. They repeat themselves. They ignore each other until maybe later chapter in the book. And they often talk past each other like talk shows of the Jerry Springer type discussions going on. They're not even paying any attention to each other. So at times it is confusing. And I wonder if that's not by design, because the book is about the difficulty we have in understanding the ways of God. At times it is not easy. Why does a loving God allow good people to suffer? Why, God? Being a follower of God does not exempt us from troubles and trials in life. Our reasoning at times may go something like this: God is in control, right? Right. He blesses those who trust and obey him, right? Right. Therefore, nothing bad should ever happen to me if I trust and obey him, right? Wrong. Job shows the fallacy of that reasoning. Job was a righteous man. He was a godly man. He trusted in God. And as the story unfolds, his life was a bad movie script. His children were like extras as they die in the opening scene of the movie. His possessions are taken away. His health is taken away. His wife turns on him. And as the plot unfolds, we have two chapters of tragedy and 40 chapters of philosophy and the head scratcher. No answers. No answers. Why do the godly suffer? The book is mute. Why does suffering at times seem so unjust? Why does justice so often seem to be absent? Why does it appear at times that life is unfair? Job is not a book of answers, but rather about a man facing circumstances over which he has no control that test his faith in God. The book helps us to recognize ourselves in relationship to God. So let us go to Job in this series we will start today, to Job chapter 1. Since the book is part of the wisdom literature of the third division of the Old Testament, law, the prophets, and the writings, it's part of the writings. I'm going to primarily use modern translations as we proceed through the book. Today, primarily, we're focusing with the NIV, New International Version. And so we come to Job chapter 1, verse 1. It says, "In the land of Uz, there lived a man whose name was Job. This man was blameless and upright. He feared God and shunned evil." Now, Job lived in the land of Uz. We have tried to figure out where Uz was. It says in verse 3 that it was east. East of where? East of Eden? I think that's John Steinbeck's book. East of what? The central location of the Bible is Jerusalem. So Uz probably was east of Jerusalem. Now, some believe that Frank Baum's The Wizard of Oz is a satire on this book, poking fun at his mother's staunch religious belief. The wizard, comparable to the wise man or righteous man of Oz, similar to Uz. So a wise man from Uz, paralleling a wizard from Oz with a plot, both of which dealing with forces of good winning over forces of evil. There's no question about Job's righteousness. In the past, we have questioned the type of righteousness, and we'll deal with that in part three, but let's continue. Verse 2, it says he had 7 sons and 3 daughters, and he owned 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen, and 500 donkeys, and had a large number of servants. He was the greatest man among all the people of the East. Verse 4, his sons used to take turns holding feasts in their homes. And they would invite their 3 sisters to eat and drink with them. Now, in the beginning of this story, everything is the way we think it should be. It was for Job. Job had the ultimate imperfection. First of all, his family, 7 sons, 7, the number of perfection, 3 daughters, 3, the number of completion, 7 plus 3, 10. Bullinger in his companion Bible says this is the ordinal perfection, ideal number like the 10 commandments, ideal number of children. The implication is that there were close ties between the siblings. In verse 4, the brothers invited the sisters to parties. Now, from our 21st century perspective, that would be unheard of, because the brothers are going to have their friends coming in and possibly a little hanky-panky going on as they invite Bambi, not the D-E-E-R, but the D-E-A-R, to the party. Plus the fact that their friends, looking at their sisters, probably want to hit on them. And the brother's not going to allow that to happen. But you look at it, it just seems to imply these children, these siblings, they were great kids. They had tremendous relationships with each other. Isn't it wonderful? As a parent, you love that. Secondly, you look at his possessions in verse 3. Note the figures, 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 1,000 animals of burden. Again, figures of perfection. So verse 5. When a period of feasting had run its course, Job would sin and have them purified. Early in the morning, he would sacrifice a burnt offering for each of them, thinking, perhaps my children have sinned and cursed God in their hearts. This was Job's regular custom. Amazing parent he was. Righteous man he was. And he was so cautious that he even offered sacrifices for his children just in case they sinned in their minds, in their hearts. Not if there's an actual sin that has been committed, but if they sin internally. Job offered sacrifices for each one of them. Awesome. Now, on the basis of that, we know that this book is written before the book of Exodus, where the Levitical system was instituted, because Job is offering burnt offerings himself. But God has given this man a wonderful life. He has perfect blessings. He's living in what we would term today utopia. Everything a man could want, he had. He would be a shoo-in for Fortune's top 100 wealthiest men, if you will. But in a matter of a few hours of one day, he lost it all. Because trouble is coming to us. Us becomes a place where very bad things happen to a very good man. Where suffering not only comes, but it comes without warning. And it comes without explanation, creating confusion and despair. All of us will spend some time in us. Some are there right now. Verse 6, one day, the angels came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan came with them. The Lord said to Satan, "Where have you come from?" Satan answered the Lord, "From roaming through the earth and going back and forth in it." Ominous thought. Peter says he is a roaring lion walking about seeking whom he may devour. He's not traveling this earth at lightning speed or supersonic speed. Satan goes around this earth walking, seeking whom he can devour. He is prowling all the time, not just seasonal. In the past, we would think that his attacks on the church were just before the Passover. Then we find problems occur just before the Feast of Tabernacles. In one of my opening night messages that became one that I use quite a bit, when we're at the Feast of Tabernacles, we are in the zone. We are in the zone and Satan's out there. And I try not to follow what is going on out there. But when you find out what's going on out there, he is prowling. And how many times we leave from the Feast of Tabernacles almost immediately, something goes wrong. So he prowls. He prowls, roaming through the earth. Verse 8, the Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job? There is no one on earth like him. He is blameless and upright, a man who fears God and shuns evil." A pretty good character reference, if you will. God said that he was righteous. If God said it, who cannot lie, the man was righteous. And when you read chapters 29 and 31, you see that Job did everything expected of him. Satan tried to find sin and couldn't. Satan tried his best to get Job to sin and was unsuccessful. This is important when Job debates his three friends, because they were convinced Job had committed some great sin, but God said the man was righteous. And Satan could find no flaw. Who were Eliphaz and Bildad and Zophar? But a point of consideration. Can I put my name there? Could God then say, "Have you considered my servant?" Put your name. "Have you considered my servant AJ? There is no one on earth like him or like her. Blameless, upright, man, woman who fears God and shuns evil." Satan doesn't think so. Satan doesn't think that our names could be placed there. Continuing, verse 9. "Does Job fear God for nothing? Have you not put a hedge around him
and his household and everything he has. You have blessed the work of his hands so that his flocks and his herds are spread throughout the land. But stretch out your hand and strike everything he has, and he will surely curse you to your face. Satan only speaks three times in the Bible, yet his footprints are all over the pages of the book. His footprints are all over history. He is prowling, he is roaming, he is stomping on human beings for 6,000 years. In Genesis chapter 3, he talks to Eve and he assures Eve that she will be God. Here, the middle section of his commenting, he accuses man to God. Man has an ulterior motive in serving you, God. And then in Matthew chapter 4, he tempts the God-man to stop following God. What we find in Isaiah 14, where it says, I will ascend into heaven, these are his thoughts. He's not talking to anyone. Here, and in chapter 2, he talks. And what is his attitude toward man? To summarize verse 9, does Job fear you for nothing? Absolutely not. Job is outwardly a decent person because he is being paid to be. He doesn't love you. He only obeys you for what he can get out of you. The only reason he is devoted to you is because you have been good to him. Stop blessing him. Let him suffer. Watch. Watch him curse you to your face. Satan believes we're all in it for what we can get. For what we can get. If we didn't get anything, or if life took a turn for the worse, would we still serve God? Would we still serve God? How bad would things get before I throw up my hands and say, I quit? I give up. How bad would they get before I go back on my calling? What is my limit? Job? Family? Marriage? Health? This is what Satan is looking to exploit. This is where his focus is. And this book, it's about a question. Question Satan asks God. And the whole book is about finding an answer to that question. Will anyone remain faithful to God even though he gets absolutely nothing in return? Or no answers to his questions of suffering? That's the theme that threads this book. Will Job curse God or cling to God when things are taken away from him, or things take a turn for the worse? So Satan still asks the question, will a man obey God for nothing? Will we obey God when bad things happen to us? Will we obey God when it appears to be getting us nowhere? When life takes a turn for the worse, will I bless God or turn my back on God? Will I doubt God or will I trust God? Will I walk by sight or will I walk by faith? That's the decision we face when life takes a turn for the worse. Satan knows human nature. Hey, he's responsible for it, isn't he? And he knows people would do just that. Let the problems come. Let them come. Let the sickness come. Let the untimely death of a loved one come. And before long, if there is no answer,
They're going to curse you, God. So in verse 10, it says an important point about us as human beings, but especially those whom God is working with. We each have a hedge around us that God opens ever so slightly. Ever so slightly at times, and let Satan in. He can't get in otherwise. There is this wall of protection around us like a fence made of thorns to keep out all attacks against Satan, his possessions, and he does the same for us. Movie came out a number of years ago, Ghost in Darkness, with Val Kilmer, Michael Douglas, based on a true story that happened 100 years ago over in the country of Kenya. Brits were over there trying to build a railroad track, hired people of Africa, hired Indians to come over to build this track outside of Mombasa. But there was a threat, two lions, and they were called the Lions of Tsavo. And these lions, like Satan, prowled. These lions were responsible for killing workers. Total number that they killed was 135. They built a hedge around the camp for those who stayed so that at least they might be able to sleep at night. The hedge was 10 feet high and spiked at the top. These lions jumped over the hedge, grabbing someone right inside of the nighttime sleeping quarters, dragging them to their own lair. They had to hire a colonel to kill the lions, J.H. Patterson. Those lions were stuffed and mounted, and they're in the Chicago Museum of Natural History today. And going over, you see them, and I can see the shot mark almost of one of them up there in the shoulder area. But you look at these lions, they look like just German Shepherd dogs. They're not that big. But when you see the pictures, these are some huge beasts. They terrorize. But the point is, there is this hedge, something that is done to keep prowlers from attacking. God does that for us. That should give us some sense of protection, whereas if God opens up the hedge, only way Satan gets in. He is asking. He is asking for us. Remember the night of the Passover? Peter, I'll never deny you. Christ talked to him, as it brings it out in Luke 22. Simon, Simon, Satan has asked for you that he can sift you like wheat. But I prayed for you. That is his desire. That's what he wants. He wants God to open up the hedge. He wants God to let Satan in. Satan has to ask permission, both in the old and in the new. But there's always that important understanding about the hedge. Something that Jesus Christ said in the New Testament, John 10, 28 to 30. John 10, 28 to 30, and I give them eternal life, and they shall never perish, neither shall anyone snatch them out of my hand. That's our intercessor. We are in his hand, and he intercedes for us. My Father who has given them to me is greater than all. No one is able to snatch them out of my Father's hand. He creates the hedge. The hedge is around us. I and my Father are one. So Satan tells God, take away the protection. And he is doing it day and night for us. Take away the protection. And he will show God that Job is really not really interested in obeying you. You've blessed him. And this is brought out in verses 12 to 19. Job passed the test, will we? Verse 12, the Lord said to Satan, very well then, everything he has is in your hands, but on the man himself do not lay a finger. Then Satan went out from the presence of the Lord. Again, what's to prevent God from doing the same to us? What's to prevent God from removing the hedge around us and letting Satan in? Nothing. Nothing. God knows our limits. He knows what we can handle and what we can't. There is no temptation taking you, but such as is common to man. But God is faithful. He is not going to allow you to be tempted above what you are able, but will with the temptation provide a means of escape. But we've got to keep in mind always, no matter what happens to us, God is in control. And see, where this book is moving is what I want to zero in on anyway. God is in control. We'll see that a little bit later. So let's read verses 13 and 19. One day, when Job's sons and daughters were feasting and drinking wine at the oldest brother's house, a messenger came to Job and said, the oxen were plowing and the donkeys were grazing nearby. And the Sabaeans attacked and carried them off. They put the servants to the sword. And I am the only one who has escaped to tell you. Verse 16, while he was still speaking, another messenger came and said, the fire of God fell from the sky and burned up the sheep and the servants. And I am the only one who has escaped to tell you. While he was still speaking, another messenger came and said, the Chaldeans formed three raiding parties and swept down on your camels and carried them off. They put the servants to the sword, and I am the only one who has escaped to tell you. Verse 18, while he was still speaking, yet another messenger came and said, your sons and daughters were feasting and drinking wine at the oldest brother's house, when suddenly a mighty wind swept in from the desert and struck the four corners of the house. It collapsed on them, and they are dead. And I am the only one who has escaped to tell you. Job lost it all. Lost his wealth, lost his possessions, his animals, and his servants in verses 14 and 17, and he lost his children, verses 18 to 19. One after one, servants came rushing to him, telling him the devastating news. You can imagine the feeling of nausea Job felt. It's like a big old sumo wrestler coming in, punching him right in the belly. And he can't even gather his breath as one after one comes to him. His livelihood has been taken away. And his servants have been massacred. These are people I'm sure Job was very intimate with. Their families, the children that are born to them. He knew them, I'm sure, by name. He may have been to weddings. If they got sick, I'm sure Job was there. They're gone. They're gone. His animals, gone. Bands of scoundrels, thieves, thugs, murderers. They have wiped him out in just a matter of hours. But that last messenger comes running to him, probably out of breath, to give him that terrible news no parent wants to hear. Your children. Your children were in the oldest son's house,
And a huge windstorm blew the house down, and none of them survived. Can you imagine how Job felt? It's one thing to lose your animals. For most human beings, animals can be replaced unless they've grown that close to them. It's one thing to lose your livelihood. Jobs can be replaced. You can't replace children. Some may think that, oh, well, hey, you're still young yet, you can have more. Uh-uh. You don't replace a child. This is devastating, and it's not just one. It's all of his children. Every parent longs to see their children grow old with families of their own. It's not natural for parents to bury their children. It still sticks in my mind. Funeral I officiated. Child that was born premature in Chicago. Having to anoint the baby in NICU in University of Chicago Medical Center. And the baby could fit in the palm of my hand. We all had hopes. This child is going to rebound, recover. God is going to intervene and heal. The little boy started growing. And at 10 and a half months, he died. And I had to officiate at that funeral. And it was so devastating to the mother, we had to postpone starting the service. She was distraught to say to her, and they had a couple of other kids, oh, don't worry, you can have another one. How heartless that comment would be. We find from Job, he has experienced devastating loss. And then he has to bury all 10 of his children. But notice what he does. Verse 20. At this, Job got up, tore his robe, shaved his head. Then he fell to the ground in worship. Job does a powerful thing in the midst of his pain. Falls on the ground and he worships. When's the last time you received some devastating news and your first thought was to worship? We're not geared that way. Not our generation, not our societies. We're more prone to ask the unanswerable questions. Why? Why? Why is this happening to me? It is so unfair. Where are you, God? 20 years ago in little town outside of Denver, Colorado, in a community that they never anticipate that there would be devastation of such a magnitude that took place at a high school. Those kind of things happen in the inner cities, not in Columbine, but it did. It did. And I still remember to this day, as a headline, after the shooting, one of the major newspapers in the United States, LA Times, and it read, quote, age-old query, where was God? End quote. It's not necessarily wrong to ask why. When Christ was on the cross, he did it, didn't he? My God, why? Why have you forsaken me? Let me ask. Did he get an answer? There's no indication in Scripture that he did. I'm sure when he went to heaven, he got an answer. But while he was on this earth, he didn't seem to have gotten one. And just as no answer probably came to him, we have no promise
in God's word that he will answer us why when we ask it. Why?
I commented on the terrorist attack that we will commemorate here in a couple of months, 9/11, 20 years. I did that in Bible study this week as we were dealing with part of scripture in the book of Hosea. And it was amazing because people were wondering, well, is this going to be the genesis of a revival in the United States? And as I'm commenting, I'm thinking back to members of Congress who were on the steps of Congress after addressing the country, and they broke out in song, "God Bless America." And my thought, what a hypocrisy. This very body that is doing its best to get rid of God, especially 20 years later, and they're singing, "God Bless America." There was a thought that this country would experience some kind of revival. Barna, George Barna, leader of the research group, he had that idea in his mind. According to his research, it says only 12% of Americans say that September 11 had an impact on their religious faith. And he said, quote, "I was among those who fully expected to see an intense spiritual reaction to the terrorist attack. The fact that we saw no lasting impact from the most significant act of war against our country on our own soil says something about the spiritual complacency of the American people. We have turned from God." So by what means, if there's going to be some kind of tragedy, that people are going to fall down and worship God? We are the ones that should. But in the societies, they are far removed from God. How far removed are we? Look at Job. Tragedy occurs. He loses everything. He worships. "My car won't start. I'm ready to take out the bat and start swinging at the car or kick the tires." Job loses his health later. "I complain if I touch a hot stove. I'm ready to curse." Job loses his children. "Something happens to my child, and I'm ready to go postal." After each of these events and the cumulative effect of them, the result of it is Job worships. Job worships. Worship is not thanking God because bad things happen. Worship is recognizing God, respecting God in the midst of tragedy. Job didn't understand why these things happened, but he did understand that God was a good God and that all things were under his control. Notice what he prayed. Verse 21. "Naked I came from my mother's womb. Naked I will depart. The Lord gave, the Lord has taken away. May the name of the Lord be praised." Job understood that he came into this world without a thing. And when he leaves this world, he would also be leaving without a thing. Even though we have had those in the past who figured they can go ahead and bury their gold with them to carry into the afterlife. Job knew that wasn't the case. And in the interim between birth and death, nobody owed him anything, not even God.
He had been blessed. Now the blessings had been taken away. And he did not know that God even had a bigger blessing for him at the end of this event. He just knew that in all things, God was worthy of worship. No, you can look at those who have been caught up in the throes of alcoholism. In the Alcoholics Anonymous, they have what they call their serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. So true in life. So true in marriage. Through the years, I've had to say to some couples, if you can't change the problem, change your attitude. Unfortunately, the problem may reside with the other, and I make the other's problem my problem. And as a result of that, I may be having more of a problem than the one who has caused it. If you can't change the problem, change your attitude. Here's where we need to reword the question from why God to show me God. Show me how you are going to help me through this. Show me how this pain is going to strengthen my relationship with you, God. Show me how you are going to work this out to my good, God. But not why. Used to get the daily paper, especially over up in Maryland, at which point in time, one of my favorite sections, two of them, the sports page, and then the other one was the comics. And I would clip out certain comic strips out of the newspaper. One of my favorite was Hagar the Horrible. And there was one, and I've got it stashed away someplace because I got files of jokes and comic strips like that. But Hagar has come back from war. And as best as I recall, Hagar has a hatchet in his helmet in one scene. His clothes are torn. He's only got on one cloth boot. He's got the black eye sign around one eye. And he is looking up in heaven and he says, why God? The second scene, there's a cloud up in the sky, dark cloud, and then there's an answer that comes through, why not? Why not? Job was able to see beyond the despair, the loss of possessions, the loss of family, and see God. Clinging to God is the only way we will survive this existence called life. And maybe make some sense out of it. This life, this world, the Titanic is sinking. And if I am not clinging on to God like Jacob did to Jesus Christ, I will drown. I will drown. Then notice in verse 22. It says, in all this, Job did not sin by charging God with wrongdoing. Job did not sin. God knew he wouldn't give up. He knew it. What about me? What's my limit? Move into chapter 2. And we'll look at the first parts of this chapter here. Kind of summarize the middle part of it. Before ending today, verse 1-3, on another day, the angels came to present themselves before the Lord. Satan also came with them to present himself before him. And the Lord said to Satan, where have you come from? Satan answered the Lord, from roaming through the earth and going back and forth in it. Again, ominous thought. He's doing that right now. We don't see it. We're unaware of it. And a counterpart of the series of Job I've dealt with, where's God in winter? And there's the upper stage and there's the lower stage. We don't know what's going on in the upper stage.
We don't know what's going on in the spiritual dimension. This is telling us. He is telling us. I'm going all around the earth, roaming, prowling, seeking whom I can devour. Verse 3, then the Lord said to Satan, have you considered my servant Job? There's no one on earth like him. He is blameless and upright, a man who fears God and shuns evil, and he still maintains, King James, New King James says, holds fast his integrity, though you incited me against him to ruin him without any reason. God again says he's righteous. And in verse 3, I want to concentrate on two expressions, two words, or an expression in a word. The New King James of hold fast, holds fast, holds fast. It's used to describe, popular word in the Hebrew, it's used to describe Pharaoh's heart, but in a negative sense. This word in the Hebrew is describing Job in the positive sense. And what it is saying is Job is just as headstrong. Job is just as stubborn. Job is just as uncompromising on the positive side as Pharaoh was headstrong, uncompromising on the negative. He did not move. He did not budge. He did not retreat from his position. We can combine the forces of nature with a hurricane, a tsunami, a volcano, an earthquake. All of that came at Job, but he didn't move. He didn't move. And that's part of what drove his wife nuts. His wife said to him, do you still hold fast your integrity? And when his three friends accused him of committing some great sin, Job had those same fighting words. Job 27, 5 to 6 says this. Job 27, 5 to 6. Far be it from me that I should say to you, say you are right till I die. I will not put away my integrity from me. My righteousness I hold fast and will not let it go. My heart shall not reproach me as long as I live. Tragedy strikes, and we're ready to start compromising. It could be I'll go binge on some food. It could be I might drown myself in some booze. It could be I can seek some kind of sexual pleasure on the internet with porn or on TV. It could be I might fuss and cuss. It could be I might fight. Job didn't. Job did not compromise his integrity. And that word integrity in Job 2 verse 3 describes his character. The Hebrew word means innocence. Innocence. Innocent of what? He's innocent of sin. Of breaking the law. He would not compromise with the law. This word is found only in the book of Job and in the book of Proverbs, four times in Job, once in Proverbs. What it says in Proverbs, Proverbs 11:3 says, the integrity of the upright will guide him. Even though things may not be going the way I want, doesn't give me the license to break the law of God. I have proven that the law is holy. The law is just. The law is good. It is my guide in life, no matter what happens. Job held fast to his innocence to the end. It says in Job 31, verse 6, the last occurrence of it in the book, let me be weighed on honest scales that God may know my integrity, my innocence. Again, his claim infuriated his friends and caused this debate, as we'll see next time,
They did not believe him. He could not be innocent. So they threw the book at him. So verse 6 of Job 2, skin for skin. It's not Job 6. Job 2, verse 4 to 6. Skin for skin, Satan replied. A man will give all he has for his own life. But stretch out your hand and strike his flesh and bones, and he will surely curse you to your face. The Lord said to Satan, very well then. He is in your hands, but you must spare his life. As it brings it out here in verse 5, this is the issue of the story. Will human beings hold fast their integrity? Will human beings hold fast their relationship with God when they get nothing in return? When they go through pain? When they go through suffering? Is our loyalty to God? Is our trust in God, depending on what happens or doesn't happen in our lives? Do I have to be healthy to believe in God? Do I have to be blessed to believe in God? Do I have to be happy to believe in God? Or will my love for God remain intact when the good stuff is stripped away and the bad stuff starts happening? Love that has to be bought isn't love, it's bribery. There was a survey taken years ago showing that toy makers watch divorce rates. When divorces rise, toy sales rise. Parents divorce, they remarry. So according to their analyzers, there are four parents, there are eight grandparents, and they tend to compete for the child's affection. So what do? Buy toys. Buy toys. Bribery, in a sense. That's what Job accused God of, bribery. So far, Job has passed the test, even though his riches are gone. His possessions are gone. Children, gone. So there's another area of his life Satan has gotten approval for. Satan doesn't figure will he make it this far, okay? He's looking to see whom he can devour. How soon before I quit? Before I give up? So Satan has gotten approval to test himself. God gave him permission to afflict him with disease. Only condition, Satan, you cannot take his life. God knows what he is doing and allowing this. He's in control. I mean, we are looking at this thousands of years later. We might be able to try to figure certain things out, and we still won't even know. One of those questions to ask in the future, what was it, God? Ultimately, yeah, I mean, he came to a deeper understanding and appreciation of God. What was it, God? He's a righteous man. Don't you want that of all of us? Do it according to the, don't you want that of all of us? Blessings upon blessings. Don't you want to do that for all of us? But then he sends us through trials. And so in verse 7, Satan went out from the presence of the Lord, afflicted Job with painful sores from the sole of his feet to the top of his head. Then Job took a piece of broken pottery and scraped himself with it as he sat among the ashes. He goes to the garbage heap with rats, maggots, flies, and gnats swarming around. But he did not curse God. The words that describe Job's sores, painful sores, same words in the Hebrew describe the plague of boils in Exodus 9
and leprosy in Leviticus 13. The NIV uses the words painful sores to describe what he had to endure. The root of the Hebrew word can mean any kind of hot or inflamed skin eruption. You go through the rest of the book, you find out how miserable this was, what Satan is capable of doing. Sores that scab over, crack, and ooze, infected with worms in chapter 7. Fever with chills in chapters 21 and 30. Darkening and shriveling of the skin in chapter 30. Eyes red and swollen from crying in chapter 16. Diarrhea, chapter 30. Sleeplessness and delirium, chapter 7. Choking, chapter 7. Bad breath, chapter 19. Emaciation, chapter 19. Excruciating pain throughout his entire body, in chapter 30, which concludes with dust and ashes. This sickness was so bad that Job's friends couldn't recognize him. His visage, his facial features, his body so changed that his friends couldn't recognize. So verse 9, his wife said to him, "Are you still holding on, holding fast onto your integrity? Curse God and die." Now, it doesn't say that Satan went back up, since Job did not curse God, that Satan went back up and said, "Well, let me work on his wife." At some point in time, he had to get approval to do that, to work on his wife. And so here we find Satan working with his wife, but he wouldn't bite the bait. She is telling him a couple of things. Abandon your faith. What has trusting God gotten you but misery? And then the second, why don't you just go ahead and curse God and die? Get it over with. I'm sure this wasn't encouraging. He's already gone through so much already. But as I go through this time and again, I have to make a comment about Mrs. Job. I only remember, I think, one time, way back, speaker, I don't know if it's a sermonette or what, got up and says, "How would you like to be married to a woman like that?" And as I go through the account, I look at it through Mrs. Job's eyes. She's lost her livelihood as well. She's lost all of her children as well. For most of us, and I will generalize it, in terms of sex, females losing a child, it's more devastating than a male. She's lost all of them. And now her husband is out here in the garbage heap. Her husband is not there to give her comfort. Her husband is not there to hold her through all of this difficulty. He's out here in the garbage heap dying. And he will die soon. And when he dies, she will be left with nothing. In a patriarchal society as back there in the Old Testament, she would be devastated. How would you like to be married to a woman like that? She stayed with him through all of this. Yes. Yes. Because a lot might just decide to leave an attitude like that. How would you like to be married? But it's understandable. It's somewhat understandable why she makes the comment. He doesn't curse God, but then notice this reply, verse 10. He replied, You are talking like a foolish woman. Shall we accept good from God and not trouble? A couple of things, because this first part of verse 10 probably caused some to think about Mrs. Job's wife in a negative light. Job did not say, you are a foolish woman. He says, you are talking like one. You are being subjected, and I don't know what he knew about Satan, but you are being subjected to the forces of evil. But then that second sentence, shall we accept good from God and not trouble? Job is struggling. He is struggling to understand what God is like. Is God the kind of being that will send evil? Is God really good? When trouble and evil comes to people, it will force them to re-examine what they really believe about God. And at the end of verse 10, it says, in all this, Job did not sin in what he said. Remember after the first wave of problems in chapter 1, it says that in all this, Job did not sin, period. Now, there's a qualification. Job did not sin in what he said in his heart. He's starting to struggle. In his mind, he's starting to struggle. He's barely holding on as life becomes more miserable. I wonder, can we relate just a little bit to what he is going through? Some know what it is like to lose finances and not be able to support a family. Some know what it is like to lose a marriage. A lot of us know what it's like to lose health. And some of us know what it is like to suddenly lose a loved one, even in anticipation. This last week, I lost an aunt. Still in Worldwide Church of God at the time, my uncle, who has been a minister a whole lot longer than I have. And here we were anticipating he'll be 92. In the fall, we figured that he would die before she would. And saw her on a Zoom women's conference that my cousin, who was a minister, was holding. And I'm looking at my aunt, and she looks just like the last time I saw her in person. Lively, full of life. And within a month, she was dead. Diagnosed with pancreatic cancer, gone. And just a couple of days before that, a cousin, gone. It happens. Most of us can relate just a little bit. But regardless of what's going on, God is in control. God is in control. If we don't believe that, like Paul said, eat and drink, because we're going to die. In this story, we can see that Satan was the one who inflicted the pain, but he was able to do so only because of God's permission. And note, Job's testing was not initiated by Satan. God is the one who pointed him out. God didn't do it to be mean. There was a purpose that God was working out in Job's life, just like he is doing in ours. And we might look at the sun shining on somebody that seems to be doing all kinds of things that are wrong, and here I am under this cloud of thunder and lightning. Why? God's in control. Over here to Romans chapter 8. Romans chapter 8, New Living Translation, 28-29. Romans chapter 8, 28-29.
New Living Translation says, "And we know that God causes everything to work together for good of those who love God and who are called according to his purpose for them." God is in control. No matter what is going on, no matter what is happening, will I hold fast to my integrity? He has a purpose, and that purpose is brought out, verse 29, "For God knew his people in advance, and he chose them to become like his son, so that his son would be the firstborn with many brothers and sisters." We have been chosen to become like Jesus Christ. So Peter interjects an important point. We use that verse in one sense without understanding the contents of that, or context of that verse. 1 Peter 2:21. 1 Peter 2:21, "For to this you were called, because Christ suffered." Christ, righteous, Christ suffered for us, leaving us an example how to deal with suffering so that we will follow in his footsteps. So in Romans chapter 9, beginning with verse 15, just read through verse 15 to 23. "For he says to Moses, I will have mercy." This is God. "I will have mercy on whomever I will have mercy. I will have compassion on whomever I will have compassion. So then it is not on him who wills, nor on him who runs, but on God who shows mercy. For the scripture says to Pharaoh, for this very purpose I have raised you up, that I may show my power in you, and that my name may be declared in all the earth." What a harsh God. "Therefore, he has mercy on whom he wills, and on whom he wills, he hardens. You will say to me, why does he still find fault? For who has resisted his will? But indeed, O man, who are you to reply against God? Will the thing formed say to him who formed it, why have you made me like this? Does not the potter have power over the clay? From the same lump, he makes one vessel for honor and another for dishonor. What if God, wanting to show his wrath and to make his power known, endured with much long suffering the vessels of wrath prepared for destruction, as he did with Pharaoh, and that he might make known the riches of his glory on the vessels of mercy, Israel, which he had prepared beforehand for glory? What is God doing in the times? I don't know. And in this life, I may never know. And you know why? Isaiah 40, 28, and I bring this out in the NIV. Isaiah chapter 40, verse 28, "His understanding is unsearchable. God's understanding no one can fathom." God's up there. I'm down here. That means God can do things that I may not agree with. God can do things I don't even like. He can allow things to happen in this life that I will never understand. He will allow people to walk into the church that I never will allow. I think back years ago when Minister and I, we went to visit a prostitute working on the streets of Baltimore, in the block. The woman started reading the Plain Truths and magazines and the booklets. And she knew if she walked into church, people would judge her, and she was not wrong. Not at all. And then there was in another church in which a boy came in with dreadlocks, and he only came once.
Only came once because of the judgment. I painfully learned God is God, and I'm not. And I'm not. Job was a man who came to understand that he didn't understand God. And it humbled him. He, along with his friends, thought they had God figured out. Especially when it came to human suffering. But both discovered that God was much more complex than our finite minds could comprehend. Also in Isaiah, in the familiar chapter, in verse 55, 8 to 9, my thoughts are not your thoughts, nor your ways my ways, says the Lord. As heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts are higher than yours. We have unfortunately too often put God in the box. God is far bigger than anything we can imagine. One of my favorite scriptures in Ephesians chapter 3. Now to him who is able to do exceeding abundantly above all that I ask or think. He is an awesome God with awesome power, and he is in control. And because he is, I trust him. And as I trust him, everything will work for good. Next time we look at Job's three friends.